Hi everybody, my name is Nat Dagnall, TSR and Community Coordinator for New Jersey. On behalf of Eastern USTA, I'd like to welcome you back to our new web series, Acing a Tennis Career. And thank you for joining our show. As you know, this is where we're going to interview different tennis professionals from our section to learn more about their backstories and just what makes them so passionate about the sport we all love. Today we're joined by Neha Uberoi. Welcome to our show. Thank you so much for being here.
Sure. Thanks for having us.
And you brought your baby. Tell us a little bit about your baby.
Yeah, so she's 7 weeks old. She's a COVID baby. We had a very stressful, chaotic delivery, but we are safe and sound at home. But it was quite stressful at the hospital. Not a fun experience, but lucky that everyone is safe and sound.
Oh, I'm so pleased that you're well and that she's well. Let me give you all a bit of background about Neha. She is a clinical mental health professional. She's a social entrepreneur. She was a former professional tennis player. Yep, she was on the pro circuit. She completed her master's in clinical social work at Columbia University. She's passionate about working with current and former athletes on their mental health and transition after sports. And she's also the co-founder and CEO of South Asians in Sports. So a really impressive resume. We're really lucky to have you on the show today. Thank you for coming.
Sure. Thanks for doing this.
So Neha, you've referenced that the climate we're in right now with COVID is quite something. What do you think the impact is of this pandemic on our mental health right now?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a great question. I think so many people are experiencing so many different emotions. And I think the levels of stress have actually only increased. You know, people thought, well, I get to at least stay at home. But then realizing that, you know, at home, there's so much work to do as well. And balancing the divide between work and play and social and, you know, your responsibilities. I think the world is kind of seeing like, hey, this is something's not working here for us. You know, this the way it used to be, what is normal, wasn't functioning for us too well. So I think there's a lot of sort of epiphanies happening and realizations happening, as well as I think people are really stressed out. This is really hard for a lot of people, especially for athletes who, you know, are in the middle of their career or preparing for the Olympics. You know, their bodies are peaking at this time, ready for Summer Olympics. And you know, it's really, the whole world is halted. So I think there's a lot of stress, there's a lot of uncertainty, and there are not a lot of fun ways to cope with that when you're stuck in the house all day.
Yeah, we're very aware of so many of our tennis players who were hoping to play Wimbledon and are still hoping to play the US Open and hoping to go out in the French Open, and there's so much uncertainty.
Right. And, you know, you think about that and then a level down, people who are, you know, on the ITF pro circuit or, yeah, you know, traveling, all of that has been halted. And it's, we don't know week to week. Do we, you know, are we going to be training for the summer, for the fall? There's so much uncertainty. And I think that that can really eat at you over time and build anxiety and stress. And I think the people who are going to kind of get through this can sort of understand that the long haul of this, that this is not something that's going to end next week or the week after, that this is really going to change the way we think about the world in a very impactful way. So, you know, those who are sort of seeing the long haul will fare better.
And at the USTA, we're trying to support people with that long haul. Well, let's dive into your story a little bit. And can you tell us a little bit about how you got started with tennis? When did you first pick up a racket?
Yeah, so I'm one of five girls. My father was a really big tennis fan. I think he went to like 14 US Opens in a row and, you know, was just glued to tennis at home. And he really wanted to put his kids into the sport, especially being an immigrant and having daughters. He thought that this was something really unique he could do, is give his kids the gift of tennis, of sport, and really so grateful for that. So I picked up a racket when I was three. I trained at Saddlebrook Tennis Academy when I was nine, about to turn 10. And, you know, it was 6 hours a day, 6 days a week, school in between, juggling it all. and went on the pro tour, you know, started playing kind of the circuit around 15 years old. Then I went to school for a year, college for a year, went to Princeton at 16.
Well, let me stop you a little bit there, because this is where it gets kind of interesting, and I want to make sure everyone really hears what you're saying. So you kind of playing tennis and you're at Saddlebrook. Were you homeschooled at that point or?
No, so actually I went to an elementary school and a middle school that was down the road from Saddlebrook. And then I would go half the day, and we sort of, you know, made the claim that I had my PE covered, so I could leave early from school. That's and smart. I would lunch in the car and then, you know, train all afternoon. And then when I got older, Saddlebrook Tennis Academy actually had their own school. So we did school as part of the program. Yeah. And then actually my high school, I did do online. Some of it was distance learning, and online school was kind of just becoming available. So I did my sophomore and junior year online.
Wow. Now, this is an amazing thing. When did you start university? What age were you?
Yeah, so I went to school, I went to college very early. I was 16 as a freshman and playing for the tennis team, and at a place like Princeton, it was not really very easy for me academically to kind of be with the people 2-3 years older than me who were unbelievably smart and so well practiced. You know, I was doing the best I could with academics, being Asian American, extremely important to my family. But I think that, you know, just like how I was elite at my sport, they were just at another level academically. So it was a really interesting experience my freshman year. One that I wouldn't take away, but definitely really the rubber meets the road, you know?
Well, you grew, and it was probably a journey in resilience, I'm sure.
Absolutely, absolutely. So after my freshman year, I went to play on the pro tour with my sister, Shika Oberoi. You know, we grew up playing middle states here in New Jersey, actually. And I played for about 5 years on the tour. My sister played a little longer. We played doubles together. And then I returned back to Princeton after 6 years. And I graduated in 2012.
I'm going to stop you there again and go back a little, because I'm sure lots of people want to know more about the pro circuit thing. So tell us the top ranking you got to as a pro on the circuit, both singles and doubles.
So I stopped pretty early. I was actually 22. Yeah. So I was 196 in singles. I think that was my high. And I think 110 or 108 in doubles. Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's amazing.
Thank you. Got to a couple tour finals, got a couple quarterfinals, played in the US Open, you know, was making my way. It was definitely a ride.
So the highlights of being on like the professional circuit, what would you say are those lasting memories for you?
I think the highlights were I think just competing in large stadiums with thousands of people watching you and television and seeing your name in lights and that adrenaline rush of competing. I think that is nowhere, you can't find that high anywhere else in anything else you'll ever do. I think I really loved that. I really think that was all those years of sweat and hard work and sacrifice to experience that kind of high for that many years, I think was so fun.
And that US Open court, tell us what it feels like when you're off.
Oh my gosh. So actually, I played on Louis Armstrong under the lights, and I played against Martina Navratilova, who was my idol when I was growing up. And the reason she was my idol is because she was the only one who wore glasses, and I wore glasses playing, and she would come into the net. She was so aggressive. And so I ended up playing her in the same stadium I watched her in as a kid. Oh, I couldn't believe it. It was a surreal moment for me. Absolutely surreal. I remember I like hit an ace in our match. We lost, Asha Roll and I, we lost pretty badly to her. But that doesn't matter, because I remember acing her and being like, oh my God, I'm sorry, I hate you. And she was like, great, you know, like, good job. Like, it was so interesting for me to just kind of see my idol on the court and play against her, then have a competitor in the very same stadium that I had that first experience with. So really something that I will always cherish.
Incredible. And then what about the tougher times? What are kind of the lowlights of being a pro?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you forget that you're competing every week. You're either winning the tournament or you're losing every week. And that can take a toll on you, you know, losing, traveling, living your life in airports and on airplanes and, you know, your bags, and maybe you didn't have a very good week and then going to the next tournament and trying to figure that out. And it's rough. It's rough out there. You know, you have to think about financially, what are you doing? You know, you might have improved something, but then it didn't apply on the court, and having to keep your head up week after week, it's tough. It's really tough. I think for me, the hard part was just like the weekly losses. You know, you're kind of up and down. And I think the ones who kind of figure out how to maintain equilibrium, whether they lose or win, are the ones that kind of come up out on top. And I think that's what it means to be a professional. And I think I struggled with that early in my career.
Okay. And did you travel alone, or were you with
your
community?
Yeah, so I was really lucky. I got to travel with my sister, Shika, who was also on the tour, and with my dad. So my sister and I had a lot of fun on the tour together. We have some great memories. We have a really, really special bond. We played doubles together too. I mean, yeah, there were some very stressful moments, but I think overall we had so much fun, so many memories, so many little inside jokes. You know, I think it really just shaped who I am and really just sort of changed my whole perception of what this world is.
So it's interesting when you think about those lowlights and then thinking about how you moved your career out of being a pro back into studying again. Do you want to tell us a little bit about why you retired and what made you want to go back to studies?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I didn't really have a really fun time towards the end of my career. I actually got an eating disorder, and I had to kind of say, hey, do you want to be healthy, or do you want to keep doing this? And I ended up having to choose to my own mental health and my wellness, and that was really hard on me. You know, the eating disorder part kind of, you know, dissipated and went away, but transitioning out of being who I thought I was going to be until I was at least in my 30s, and trying to find something next and who I was and what I liked and what did I want to study, or, you know, just kind of more than before all that, just what was my value? You know, what value do I have now if I'm not this celebrated athlete? And I think that was really, really hard for me. And it is hard for many athletes. And, you know, I didn't find a lot of resources that could kind of tell me, okay, this is how you start over, or this is how you transition out of one thing and go to another one. Because I had grown up in the sport, it had shaped so much of who I was and my self-worth and everything, you know, the healthy ego. And so having to kind of reshape that to explore and to launch myself off of that platform and see it as a strength was really difficult. And I really wish there were better resources out there for me and people who had gone through it, who were sharing what they had gone through, which people are now.
Yes,
but normal. Yeah, it was not fun. But one thing I have to say about tennis is that because it really is a game of life, you know, it really is a game for life, and it's a game of life because you are out there by yourself. There's no one else there, your opponent. There's so many variables. And you can always relate what you're going through to the game and to what you learned and how to apply those skills. It's not always that obvious, but if you do any internal self-reflection, which I feel like a lot of tennis players do, I think it's really beautiful. You know, I'm saying this in hindsight. Going through it wasn't so fun, but looking back, it's a really beautiful experience.
So that's interesting. So you talk about how it's a beautiful experience, and then you almost need support or tools at the time to make sure that while you're going through it, it can still be that beautiful experience. And that's part of what you're doing for people now, isn't it?
That's exactly right. Yeah. So I've been studying kind of this transition. What are people going through? What are the pain points? What are the resources that we need to make this easier? And also to make being a professional athlete an asset for later in life.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, what I'm finding is, yes, the identity piece is really key. And that starts from a very young age, Natalie. You know, if you are only a tennis player and that's all you are, it will be very hard to kind of move forward. But if you can balance your life and your identity and your worth around other things around you, I think that that balanced approach not only helps you on the court because you have more of a relaxed attitude, but I think it also helps you later in life. And you don't know when your career is going to end. You know, it could end tomorrow. It could end in 20 years. You don't know. So you have to be prepared as an athlete, unlike other professions like a physician or a lawyer or, you know, other places where you're not using your whole body.
And it's interesting the way one uses a career these days, because it's really a chapter of evolution, which is partly what you're talking about, that the skills you learn through one opportunity can translate across to skills in the next, which is what tennis does. So tell us a bit more about the transition piece that you work on. Why, how are those tennis skills transferred to other careers successfully?
Right. So this is so funny because, you know, you think, well, how do those thousands of forehands I hit translate into the boardroom or into my first entry-level job in marketing? You know, it doesn't make sense, right? Like, how am I going to move this thing that I did into something that can launch me? And I think the first thing that a lot of elite athletes suffer with is this idea of having to start from the bottom again, because mm-hmm. you've been successful at such a young age doing something that you're like, oh wait, I'm not good at something, this is hard for me to take. So I think the first thing is kind of just accepting that you're in a level playing field, you're learning how to hit the stroke again, and that's an uncomfortable feeling that you're going to have to just brace yourself for, and you can have fun with it, you know, because you clearly know that you have the skills of you know, you have willpower, you have discipline, you know how to face adversity, you know how to think about strategies, you have all of these soft skills that you can apply once you've found which direction you want to go in. So I think the hardest thing for a lot of athlete transitioning is not how do I get to the next thing, it's what is the next thing, and once they've found it, there's no stopping them. And you know, it's scary because you have to try stuff, you have to put yourself out there, you have to not be good at something, and that's hard for the ego, you know, it's hard.
Especially being used to the lights and the big tennis courts.
Exactly. And what do you mean I have you're only going to pay me this much, like I should be running the company, I could take it, you know. So it is, there is a little bit of grandiosity in thinking, a little bit of that does happen, which you can use to your advantage. As long as you're aware that you're going to have these feelings, you're going to have these thoughts, this is what it's going to be like. And, you know, having someone to talk you through it, or a mentor, someone who's been through it, it can be profoundly helpful.
So tell us about your journey then. You went back, you studied, and then tell us what you did thereafter.
Yeah, so I did my undergrad in sociology, and then I actually went into marketing. I was really looking for that startup, that, you know, entrepreneurial, where I could use kind of all of my energy. I had so much energy. Where could I put it? I didn't land on anything particularly exciting, in my opinion, but I still was like, okay, let me get the skills. You know, maybe marketing is a route I want to go. And I found that I really did not like it. I was good at it. I was getting promoted. I was, you know, doing a good job. I was learning fast, but I just didn't have the passion. And for someone who's come from sport, where it's all about passion and, you know, just putting yourself out there, I really felt like I was lacking. It was lacking. And it was really hard for me to wake up and go to work every day when I wasn't fully invested. And I know a lot of people are able to kind of just go to work and go through the grind and, you know, pays the bills. I could not for the life of me just, you know, go to work and come home. And so I went on a search, you know, I dabbled in all kinds of things. You might see remnants of that online, you know,
my YouTube channel. I did, I saw lots of stuff.
Yeah. My writing, fitness, you know, I wanted to find where can I be most useful? You know, what is it that makes me unique? All the questions that I think we all have, regardless of our journey. And it landed me to social work and really understanding that I could help people, you know, directly through either clinical practice or education and policy making. So I ended up going to grad school. I just finished in May, just now, and along the way, I had two kids along the way. I don't recommend going to grad school and having children at the same time, but, you know, it is what it is.
Different ways to do things.
Yes, and I'm now really looking to work with athletes, both who are currently, you know, playing on their mental health, their performance. The studies are, you know, or rather the people are out in the profession are now seeing how much the line is blurred between having a healthy lifestyle and how that translates to performance. Yeah. You know, and it's not just about sports psychology now, it's about the whole being, the whole athlete. And that's what really interests me, and it's something that I would really like to pursue.
Yeah, I think I think it becomes increasingly topical and highlighted in the current climate as well.
Exactly.
And you also have an emphasis on South Asians in sport. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your business and why you've had that focus?
Sure. So South Asians in Sports is something I started 5 years ago. Really the aim, it's a nonprofit, and the goal really is to get more South Asians, people who identify with being South Asian, into working in sports. I think that what I've seen from when my sister and I were on the tours, we didn't see a lot of people, A, playing professionally, but also just around sports in the industry, as you know, as business people, as doctors, as agents, as sports writers. We didn't see that. And it's obviously a lot of it is cultural, but I think that when we can you know, promote it and support people who are wanting to make this a career, I think it's very important. The South Asian impact can be huge. And it's also a great career. Sports is a great career, whether you play sports or not. But just being in the business of sports, I think, is important. And I think as South Asians, at least here in North America, we've sort of dominated medicine and technology. And even, you know, we're in politics, even Hollywood. But we don't have that presence in sports. And my mission, or the mission of South Asians of Sports, is really to kind of bring us, you know, to the conversation, and I think we can do that by just promoting the industry.
Fabulous. And I definitely feel that there's a huge amount of participation actually playing the sport by South Asians in tennis. So then you think, well, career opportunities that don't necessarily have to be pro, but other opportunities within tennis are vast.
Exactly. I mean, I think it's a lot to ask, you know, hey, put your kid in professional sports. You know, that's a big ask, at least culturally. But it's also, you know, I think saying, hey, are you a doctor? Are you a lawyer? Are you a professional? You know, do you have your MBA? Why don't you move that into, you know, your skill set into sports? And I think that's where we can see a lot more diversity. You know, eventually I want my organization to be irrelevant. Like, why would you ever have
it? Why do you need it?
Yeah, why would you need it? But I think we're a long way from there.
And I think the pathway to getting there is doing exactly what you're doing. So I think it's fantastic.
Thank you.
So let's pivot a little and talk a little bit about your heroes. So who's your tennis professional hero and why?
Well, when I was younger, it was Martina Navratilova.
Like, you said.
Like, honestly, only because she wore glasses and came to the net. Like, I don't even have more to say than that. But she was awesome. You know, I think growing up, Andre Agassi, always tried to mimic him with his forehand and his footwork, and his eye-hand coordination was just so unbelievable. I really love watching Federer. I love watching
I mean, that's so given, right? Like, I can't even say Federer. Like, who doesn't like Federer? You know, I like, right now, I think who's really fun to watch is Naomi Osaka. I really like her. I think she has a great personality. And she's so cute. I really like her.
Yeah. And she has a real future. And she's got everything.
She does. She really does. And on the men's side, there's so many people coming up, and it's so cutthroat. So it's so fun to watch, you know, all the competition and the camaraderie that's there. But I'd say my heroes, Andre Agassi, his book actually was so helpful to me. And Steffi Graf, when I was a child, I mean, she was just, you know, we had this thing in our household where we had to sleep at 8 o'clock. And somehow my dad had learned that Steffi Graf sleeps at 8 p.m. I don't know if this is true or not. I'd love to ask her one. It was just like, Steffi Graf sleeps at 8 p.m. We were like, oh, my God, she does. Okay, we're going to do it. We're going to sleep it. And it worked. We would be in the bed 8 p.m. sharp. You know?
So we referenced a few parents there with Steffi Graf and yourself with an influencing dad and Andre Agassi. What do you think of the role of parents and role modeling for parents in tennis?
That's a good point. I think, you know, parents get a lot of flack for being, you know, strong-willed and abusive and, you know, really pushing their children around, which is all true. I'm not denying that those things happen. But I think there's another side that we forget to look at, that, you know, parents, at least in the cases that we've talked about, are also the ones who are so dedicated to helping their children achieve that level of greatness and, you know, putting themselves second and really sacrificing for their children. I think that's just something that sometimes we should kind of keep in mind. You know, even just saying parents in sports has that negative connotation. And I kind of want to pause sometimes and say, hey, wait a minute. They're the ones that are, you know, are there sacrificing and waking the kids up at 4 a.m. and driving them to tournaments and doing all that. So, yes, there are a lot of crazy tennis parents and all of that out there. But I think that the sport wouldn't survive without parents. So we can't forget that.
So I'm going to ask you one last question, then let you go back to your baby, who's been so great. Thank you for bringing him on the show. So a fun question. What is your most controversial tennis opinion? Like, I'm not a fan of this, or something controversial to share with us.
Well, I think that coaching should be allowed. I'm all for it. I think it would be a great asset to tennis, both for viewership as well as for the athletes. I don't care what you say. Coaching happens whether it's not allowed or allowed. People are going to coach, so you might as well market it and you know, make it open. I think it would be a game changer, and it's really interesting. I know the WTA, when I was playing, we had a little bit of coaching, and then they stopped it, and then they started it again. I'm all for coaching.
And they coach at the D1 level and D3 level at colleges.
Exactly. In college, I coach all the time. I really enjoyed that when I was a student, you know, having the coach on the court with me, cheering me on. I mean, maybe they shouldn't be on the court, but, you know, something where it's open and people can see it. Maybe they're mic'd up. I think it'd be so fun.
So much fun. I think at the US Open last year, in the juniors, they allowed coaching. They were exploring
that. I think just all the Grand Slams need to get together and say, yes, I do this. Wimbledon, looking at you.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on our show. You've been fantastic. And I wish you everything of the best with your baby. It's a very exciting time to have a
thank you. I know.
Yeah. And we look forward to collaborating with you more at Eastern and supporting all the fantastic work that you're doing.